Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another Bite Marks special episode. And joining me today is a very special guest. Say hello, Sibu.
How's it going, Emilio? Hi. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing all right, all things considered.
Not to date the episode, but the onrush of Christmas does definitely mean a lot of planning.
Yes, yeah, lots of frenetic movement and trying to avoid as many trips to the mall as possible.
And speaking of a cultural black hole, today's episode is one that I've wanted to do for a while, and that is to talk about conservatism in art. And why don't you tell the audience why exactly you're here?
Well, I am interested in art. I'm an art teacher. I'm a practicing artist. And I have a almost pathological love for art. It doesn't even really matter if it's art that I dislike. I still like to read about it. Mm. So I've got a fairly broad knowledge of a lot of movements that have occurred through history, but obviously, like, my strengths are what are related to the high school syllabus, because those are the things that I have to know on a sort of weekly basis. So that's kind of going to inform a little bit about what we're looking at today.
Yeah. So I, for my own sake, I consider, you know, on this channel, we believe that video games are art. And one of the reasons why I believe that is because I think there is something fundamental to the way that you can use a video game to not only express yourself, but also, you know, broadly express ideas. But just because, you know, video games are art doesn't necessarily mean that they aren't also, you know, in a way, products. And more so than many other kinds of mediums, video games have taken on a kind of a commodified way, and that has left many other traditional mediums, illustrations, paintings, sculptures, murals, etc., maybe a little bit less in the public eye. So what I wanted to talk to you today about was inspired by watching a very cringy anime, I guess, for lack of a better word, called Last Son of the West, which I don't recommend anyone go watch. It is basically what I would call kind of an artistic black hole. Someone tried to make every Ben Shapiro, Jordan Peterson talking point into a video, and they chose to do this by basically ripping off basically a number of, you know, popular animes. And it got me thinking about the way in which conservatives, you know, think about art, because from my perspective, the perspective of, you know, a leftist, someone who engages a lot in, you know, in this media space, is that conservatives don't really like art. They spend a lot of time decrying the quote-unquote postmodernism, you know, of a lot of, you know, modern day art, and ignoring, you know, how artists are evolving and changing. And they kind of have this weird fetish for, you know, old historical work, not because that work has merit, but because it's old and historical and, you know, confirms to their biases. Like, there was a lot of controversy over, you know, I'm not sure if you saw this, but the discovery by some art historians that, you know, many of the white marble, you know, Roman statues were in fact originally designed to be very painted. And when they did reconstructions, you know, they looked very different to this, you know, classical idea of, you know, the quote unquote, the Western, you know, artistic tradition. And so, you know, you're here to facilitate what I hope will be an interesting conversation. So why don't you please get into it?
Sure. So, yeah, I will largely be speaking off the cuff. I have prepared some things to refer to, but touching on that story about the marble paintings, there's a really good series by CBS where they actually talk about that. It's available on YouTube. But yeah, that whole issue comes down to the idea of creating a canon, deciding what is and what isn't art historical, what is of value, what is art, what is not. And it's something that we can't really shake because it's very much tied in with aspects of colonialism, aspects of education, wealth, global power, all of that. You know, we have a not, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's a joke, but just something that people generally understand within the art world is that if it's art made by women, it's craft. If it's art made by non-Westerns, then it's fetish. So it's like, we look for the religious function of artworks made by non-Western, non-European peoples, while almost ignoring the religious function of artworks made in the Western canon. So, you know, we acknowledge that artworks by Da Vinci or Michelangelo have a religious flavor to them, but we don't see them as having a religious function necessarily. But yeah, so that's a little beside the point. But yeah, so, you know, you touched on the idea of commodification, and I think that's one of the things that I actually want to talk about today is, like, how do we distinguish what is conservative art and what is not? Because a lot of the time, like, I don't consider myself a conservative artist. The artworks that I like to make are not necessarily pretty. They're not necessarily things that you want to put up in your bedroom, in your lounge, in your foyer, if you have one. They tend to be things that are more about me exploring the things that I'm interested in, and the things that I'm interested in and have been interested in for a long time are a film aesthetic. So there's a kind of roughness to it. It's unsettling. There's a lot of, like, fleshy, hairy bits and pieces coming together. So, you know, it's all the things that make us beautiful, our skin, our hair, our teeth, but all in the wrong places. And then there's also the things that I like, that, like, pop art, cartoon art, graphic art. Those are the things that I like to do. So I find myself in a weird space where I don't really want to pursue art that has meaning all the time. And when I do go for art that has meaning to me, it's not really art that is beautiful or saleable. And I think things that can make art conservative would be, as you mentioned, hearkening back to traditions, are pretty, things that are safe, things that are established as art. Okay, so, you know, you want a nude by Anger or Renoir. You don't want a nude by Francis Bacon or Lucian Freud, because the former are creating nudes that are beautiful and meant to be looked at, while the latter will be making nudes that are challenging and confront you.
I was going to say that I think, you know, I want to really touch on this idea of, like, what makes people think of art as part of, you know, conservatism. How is it the case that people create art and then they enfold it into conservatism? Because so, for example, you know, I've seen I've been to a number of art galleries, and I've seen some very, you know, gorgeous art. But whenever I learn about the history of, you know, the majority of these artists, I find that many of them are not the kind of people, you know, that would be readily adopted by conservatism today. So, for example, you know, Oscar Wilde or even, you know, Shakespeare. Shakespeare is often, you know, PragerU makes a great statement, how do you do that? Oh, you know, we're not being taught Shakespeare in schools anymore. Now, I would argue that we most likely still are being taught. I was taught Shakespeare, and I'm sure that you were as well. But we should broaden the horizons, because Shakespeare is kind of like a universal story. But Shakespeare himself is not a conservative person. He was a progressive person who, in the context of his time, made decisions and choices that were deliberately designed to offend, or at least in part, to progress against the sensibilities of the conservatives of his time. You know, he has characters of questionable sexuality. He has topics that really deconstruct power dynamics. Macbeth is a great example. You know, and I feel as if it's a strange idea, right? I really want your thoughts about how is it that people take these artists, and even though they themselves don't, you know, fit into conservatism, how is it that they are made conservative?
Well, I was actually, in preparation for this podcast and this discussion, I was chatting with Sai, because we have a lot of similar interests, a lot of similar outlooks, but very different backgrounds. So she chose the route of getting into information design because information design is one, more marketable and
oh yeah,
you know, more guaranteed income when you're in that actual stream, and two, it services people. You know, everything that an information designer or any kind of designer at all makes is functional. The value of design, the split between good and bad design is how well does it meet its function, or in the case of bad design, how does it fail to meet its function, or how intrusive is it while meeting its purpose? So we've got very interesting conversations that we get to have around this. And one of the things that we were talking about was the idea of what if we look at the word conservative, I think it's kind of been tainted, and this isn't to, like, you know, airbrush conservatism or anything. I stand against it. It's not something that it's something that I hope I don't end up adopting. But I do understand it because, you know, the world is a scary place. It's changing all the time. I've got like 5 internet connected light bulbs in my house, and I'm just worried that one day I'll be taken over in a botnet. So, you know, I've got a kind of like technological conservatism to me. But a lot of it comes down to nostalgia and fear of things going wrong, because things always go wrong. But the things that we are nostalgic for are not the things that went wrong when we grew up. They were the things that were good, that were comforting, that we understood. I think conservatism...
I just wanted to say something quickly, because you know, you reminded me of something. There is a filtering effect on artwork of basically everything that society does. And this filtering effect essentially means that when you're growing up, there are good and bad bands, right? There are terrible musicians, there are good musicians. But over time, what happens is a filter is applied to them, and only the good musicians really survive and become well-known and remembered. And the same is, you know, true for art. There were plenty of hacks in Da Vinci's
but
day.
But I think...
but, you know, he survived.
Oh, yes.
And,
yeah, so I think, yeah, that's exactly a part of it. Like, there's the filter of what makes it through, what becomes part of history, what value appreciates and what gets forgotten and discarded. And unfortunately, this segues nicely into the next thing. Conservatism in terms of being conservative as a kind of financial or economic outlook is what I actually want to touch on next, because a lot of what we consider good is what was marketable and good. Because if there's no market, if there's no material sort of value or worth assigned to the artworks, it becomes very difficult to preserve them. You know, like Basquiat, for example, or Keith Haring would be the furthest thing from conservatives, but their works have appreciated so much over time that, you know, aside from the fact that now everyone is copying Basquiat and using his signature doodles in their Instagram photos, aside from that, that he's had such a long-lasting impact, he's familiar now. He's become kind of sanitized in a sense. It's no longer shocking because we've seen it. We've been exposed to it since the 90s, some of us more locally since like the 2000s, 2010s, with the internet becoming more accessible. But I think another definition that I saw for conservative art is art that sells. So art that can be bought, art that can be sold, art that doesn't rely on government funding, art that isn't experimental and leaves no trace, art that isn't ephemeral or time-based. Those are the kinds of artworks that are conservative because they have a market value. Whereas certain types of art require maybe private funding, maybe public funding, maybe they are made with no funding at all, but they don't leave a they don't leave behind an object that someone could want, that someone could commodify. So that's another kind of split between what's conservative art and what's not. And if we look at what a lot of people want to buy, we had a market recently that we participated in and we showed our works. And one of the people asked if we don't have things that are nice to look at, landscapes, portraits of dogs, or pictures of animals that weren't wearing bondage gear and paraphernalia.
So
I think, there's a couple of ways of looking at the idea of what does it mean to be conservative in art. And there's the nostalgic aspect that we discussed, where people want something that's familiar, where people want their Thomas Kincaids, they want their landscapes by Porci, that kind of nostalgia-driven conservativeness. There's the kind of market-based conservative art, where you know, you might have an artwork that, for all intents and purposes, its message is very radical and leftist and against the grain, but because it is something that can be picked up, packaged, bought, exhibited in different galleries and museums, traded between collectors, and therefore its provenance can be built up, it begins to have a kind of pedigree of its own value and can start to accrue worth. That is kind of a monetarily conservative function. You know, it's no longer about the meaning of the work. It's just about the, how can we game this work to have a higher appreciation?
You know, it's really interesting that you say that. So there, like, I have this belief that most human beings have a desire to create something. I think most people are, at least in some respect, creative. Maybe they don't want to make sculptures or paintings, but they want to do something that they feel, you know, expresses themselves creatively. And I could, you know, then say that, okay, well, maybe most human beings have some desire, you know, more or less to make art. But if you look at the history of art, and in particular, you look at the history of what I would call the art industrial complex, then basically, for the most part, most people are not, you know, upper class. Most, like in the Middle Ages, in the antiquity period, most people are not, you know, powerful nobles who have the ability to compel other people, artists, for example, to make portraits of them, to make sculptures of them, etc., etc. A lot of art in that classical sense, the art that survives, of course, is art that is aggrandizing to an individual. Even though I'm sure people in villages and towns and stuff like that were creating stuff and expressing themselves, that stuff wasn't designed, you know, to really be saleable. It wasn't really designed, you know, for another person. It was designed for, you know, themselves. And so I think it's much easier to lose that. Then, as, you know, the Middle Ages develops, as society moves away, as feudalism becomes more entrenched, then, you know, you get this idea of, you know, the art and the patron, where you have artists who are trying to find powerful, rich people to justify their existence, you know? And nowadays, it is kind of, in capitalism, it's kind of become even more abstract, where artists are competing in invisible marketplaces to produce material that is saleable. And, you know, that for conservatives, for many conservatives, you know, they see that something has value because it is, you know, saleable. They don't necessarily, like, I keep coming back to Prageru, but Prageru is completely artistically illiterate, right? They can't look at a piece of artwork and then actually analyze what the themes and meaning of that art are. They look at it, they see who it is by, you know, who the provenance is, and then they go down a checklist, and if it hits all the checkboxes, then they go, this art is good, you know? No, very few conservatives can really explain why it is that the art that they like is good. They can only kind of gesture vaguely at, quote unquote, the values that it has. Am I making sense? Does that?
Yeah, you are. But I also wanted to just say, like, I think, I think generally maybe society is more conservative than I imagine. But I think just in general, people do struggle with the kind of like analysis of art. It's not that it's difficult. It's just that it's unfamiliar.
Because yeah, no, I agree.
When I look at, you know, as a teacher, like, the skill I have to teach, and in any year, I'm lucky if I get 10% of grade choosing my subject. So I think there's a big devaluation of art and artistic literacy, visual literacy, in general. It comes from a lot of things. It comes from the fact that for a lot of people, they stop having mandatory art as part of their education in grade 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. And then it picks up again in high school, and then they start taking it further. So we don't have the same kind of emphasis or focus on visual literacy as a skill in the same way that we have numeracy or actual literacy, language literacy.
I'm a teacher myself, and you know I teach university students, but you know I can very much see the same thing. A lot of my students are people who can't really analyze, you know, something critically in the way that I want them to. And that is because the way that our education system is kind of geared up is, I hate to say this, but it's mostly designed to make cogs in a machine. It's not really designed to make people who are really capable of doing independent, you know, free thinking analysis. And this only benefits, you know, conservatism, really, because once you start to look at the world in a more critical way, once you start to look at the media that you consume in a more critical way, you know, then you start to be able to reject, you know, the narratives that, like, I blame the lack of like general media literacy for the huge numbers of people who watch Star Wars movies and don't really comprehensively get that the Empire are space Nazis, right? maybe I'm a little bit hyperbolic there, but I generally feel as if more people were given the tools to be more critical about, you know, the media that they consume, I think we'd have fewer people who play video games or watch movies or read books and kind of just totally miss the point, you know?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you. I mean, like, I don't want to sound like an essentialist and say that some people reach their limit and can go no further. I do think it is about a combination of interest and practice and exposure. But I think, you know, with that in mind, you know, every once in a while, I stumble across like an intelligent person who is like a libertarian or a conservative racist. And, you know, it's like, obviously they're going through the right thought processes, but the conclusions that they're coming to are, from my standpoint, completely wrong. Mm. And I think that's one of the things that's kind of interesting about art, that even if everyone gets to the same level of visual literacy, level of understanding, level of critical analysis, we're still going to have, you know, a variety of interpretations. And I think that's great. That's a good part of art, of media in general, because there are so many ways for the individual to interpret it. And, you know, obviously some are more valid than others, but yeah, that's just kind of where we'll find ourselves. But I think, I think you're right. Obviously, there is a kind of market force that drives the structure of education in primary school, high school, and tertiary institutions. And art doesn't really fit into that. You know, I mean, like, when I was studying art, I had other kids who were doing BA telling me that my degree was useless. So, you know, like, there's always somewhere to punch down. We laughed at the theology students. So, you know, there's definitely an undervaluing of creative thought, of creative ability. And what's more disheartening or more upsetting than that is that I've noticed that there's a kind of an upswing in how these fields can be valued, but again, it's for commercial purposes. It's to fit into a part of the HR system or whatever, because you understand how people think. And that's more BA in general, I guess. So, you know,
it's always difficult because I come from kind of the opposite end of the problem. I come from, you know, a background where everyone's like, you want to study computer science, you know, you want to get a high paying job as a programmer or whatever. And I meet scores of kids who fail out of this course, you know, out of this program, year in and year out, because it's not the thing that they're really interested in. You know, I'm sure it's not necessarily a question of intelligence, but it's really like, do you want to apply yourself?
It's not
to
where
this?
Their hearts are.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people are forcing themselves to do a thing that I don't think they really want to do. And consequently, they don't really end up succeeding. And it is. And the only reason is this, right, is because there are financial incentives to it. 100 years ago, it was something else. It was mechanical engineering, for example, you know, or being a lawyer. And it's just like, well, you don't really want to do this. You have no interest in doing these things because, you know, there are people who naturally have those inclinations. I think I'm one of those people. And I'm always upset that my students are so narrowly focused on a thin conception of success that they don't want to broaden their horizons, you know, that they don't want to, you know, understand things that are not like, quote unquote, the hard sciences. Like, this is why I feel, you know, I did an episode somewhat recently about education, and it was like, well, a lot of the reasons why so many of the engineer dude bros are like libertarian or, you know, alt-right or, you know, right-leaning is because they don't have much in the way of the ability to understand things that don't already conform to their biases, you know? They are always indoctrinated with the idea that they're special, that they're individuals, that individual success is important. And then when you confront them with group ideas, when you, you know, confront them with group problems, they don't have the ability to think about those problems, and therefore they chalk it up to being beneath them or, you know, somehow unimportant. And that's, you know, a big issue. But we did also want to talk about something else. So, and that was futurism.
Yeah.
So take it away.
Yes. So I think maybe just one last thing on the previous topic before I hit futurism is there's a kind of, I don't know, ironic quality that emerges out of the sort of conservative desire for tradition and the art market's desire for novelty, in that it's very difficult to make novel traditional art. It's antithetical. the art market is going to want to exploit things that are new and haven't been seen before. So that's why there's been a big upsurge in artists from Africa on the sort of global stage, which is great for the individual artists. But, you know, ultimately, it's best for the people who are buying the work. They are the ones who are really gaining something. And I think, you know, that kind of, a lot of the artworks that are being made that are sort of new, novel, interesting, explore ideas, explore techniques, explore media, they're sometimes difficult to latch onto when your only experience of art is, you know, a very classic sense of what art should be, or maybe it's just postcards, or maybe it's just paintings you see at curio stores. So you have a very, as you mentioned earlier, limited worldview that you, it becomes harder to appreciate things that are too far outside of that. Again, faltering, eventually those things become familiar. They become part of the narrow worldview, and they become easier to digest and accept.
Yeah, I would point to something like the widespread popularity of something like K-pop as a perfect demonstration of the fact that, yeah, sure, there is an Overton window on, you know, what you might consider to be acceptable music, but eventually what will happen is your desire for novelty and the inability of tradition to satisfy that novelty will lead you to new things and new ideas, and that eventually those new ideas and new things will become incorporated into the system and, you know, driving the process all over again. It's kind of eldritch, you know, in a way.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you can't really shift the center. You just get closer to it. cultural hybridization.
Futurism. So what is futurism and how does it relate?
For K-pop, but yeah. So futurism, futurism is a modernist movement. Modern in art refers to something different to how we use the word modern in everyday speech. So for everyday speech, modern is what's happening now, currently it's new. In art, it refers to a specific moment where in Western tradition, artists were breaking away, or rather, in Western canon, artists were breaking away from tradition. So it ties in with a lot of, it ties in with the Industrial Revolution, because we have factories, we have cities developing, we have new technologies developing, and most importantly, we have the camera as a more widely available technology. So the camera, the word means room in Italian, comes from camera obscura, which means the dark room. And as everyone knows, it allows you to take a true-to-life representation of what's in front of the lens. So that allowed artists to begin to explore, because one of the roles of artists was to create things that were documentary. Like you mentioned earlier, you make a portrait of the person who commissions you so that they can remember what they look like, so that it can become part of their estate, because images have power. But now artists can shift away from creating representational art and can start to create more idea-driven or experiment-driven art.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of starts to kick off with the Impressionists. I mean, not specifically, but they're one of the earlier movements that start to explore this, what we would then call modernism. So this is in the late 19th century. Then early 20th century, around 1909, 1908, we have a group of Italian artists called the Futurists. So the Futurists were interesting and unique in a couple of ways. For a start, they were Italian. Most other avant-garde, most other avant-garde movements were French, specifically from Paris, because Paris was, you know, the cultural hub.
I think I think historically we tend to overestimate just how. I think we've created an image of a pan-European identity, just sort of.
Yes,
that hasn't really existed. I think a lot of people tend to forget that Italians were once like on the outside of whiteness.
Yeah, I mean, Italians then Greeks, I imagine, but neither really had much impact in terms of creating the idea of like modern Europe, even though both of them are credited with like classical Europe.
Please carry on.
Yeah, so
Italian
essentially
futurists.
Modernism is getting rid of everything that the Italians and Greeks, the Romans and the Greeks, contributed to European art at that point. So no more realism, no more perspective, no more academic paintings, academic painting being smooth application of your brush strokes. Instead, we opt for distortion. We opt for flattening the sense of depth. We opt for rough, broken brushstrokes and divisionism. So divisionism is a technique that was developed by the Neo-Impressionists. The Impressionists loosened their brushstrokes, but they were still, painting in a way that looked like you are applying paint to the canvas and smearing it. They weren't blending their paint necessarily. They were putting patches of color next to one another so that the colors appeared to blend when you looked at them. But if you look at an artwork by Manet, for example, or Renoir, or Degas, you'll see that there is still a sense of creating form out of mixing your colors on the canvas, even though they still applied these optically blended patches of color around their image. It was the Neo-Impressionists who felt that Impressionism's exploration of how light appears to the viewer needs to go further, needs to be more structured. So the Neo-Impressionists start to bring ideas of composition and planning back into their work. And they also develop a very sort of controlled way of applying paint in little dots. And that's what they call divisionism, because you're breaking the light up into spots of color that when you look at it from a distance, they begin to resolve into a sort of cohesive image. Similar to how, you know, pixels on a screen work, but all placed by hand.
Oh, I've seen that actually. It looks really nice.
Yeah, so Georges Seurat is a nice example. I think everyone's seen Le Grand Jatte, even if they don't know the name. But it's a painting of some Parisian folk enjoying a sunny day on the banks of a river.
Yes, I've seen. I've definitely seen that one.
So it's painted in little dots. You can see the dots, but the dots aren't so abstract that you can't tell what you're looking at. So I'm going to put a pin in that because it's going to come in handy later. Now the back to the futurists. So the futurists, they started in Italy, which was unusual. They named themselves, which was also unusual. Very few movements at that point got to name themselves. The Fauvists, another early proto-modernist movement, were called the Fauvists because allegedly a critic considered their work to be wild and beastly. And at the first exhibition that they were displayed at was at a there was a sculpture that was done in the style of Donatello, and these paintings with wild, unnatural colors surrounded it. And the critic looking at it said, look, there's Donatello amongst the beasts. Except he was a French critic, so he was saying it in French, and my French is pretty bad. And what I remember it being was Donatello milieu aux fauves, which means Donatello among the
It's the
beasts,
beast, hence the
and
name.
hence the name. So they were called the beasts. And making art in their style was essentially making beastly art.
That's pretty cool.
And then they took it. It became their name. It was an insult. It became a badge of honor. So this is something that happens throughout art. If you look at Gothic art, it was considered barbaric, hence linking it to
The
the
Goths,
Goths, the Germans. It was never made by the Germans. It was never made by the Goths. It was just considered ugly and uncouth, but it eventually is the name that stuck. But the futurists named themselves. And among the names that they were choosing between was dynamism, electricity, and futurism. And futurism is the one that won out. So futurism kind of gets started by a man named Tommaso Filippo Marinetti. So he was a poet initially, and he wrote the Futurist Manifesto. So it's one of the few art movements that also, again, weirdly, started without any art. It started with writing. And this kind of posed the problem for the futurists because they had these strong ideas, but they didn't necessarily know how to get them out there, how to make them visible. This is still some time before conceptual art where it would have been acceptable to leave it at an idea and nothing more.
They needed to back up their words, so to speak.
Essentially, they needed to have something to show for it, or they felt they needed to. And one of the ways that they did this was by taking aspects from other movements, specifically divisionism, because they felt that divisionism could be used to show motion blur, not just color, not just light. And I mean, it makes sense. If you look at a smear panel in an animation, you see the image broken up and connected. So it's one thing that has been fragmented and combined. So we see that a lot in futurist art, such as Bala's dynamism of a dog on a leash. But it stands at odds with the goals of futurism because the futurists want to, as the name implies, progress into the future. They feel that Italy has been hamstrung by tradition. It's why it's been left behind because they can't let go of pasta. They can't let go of the Renaissance and the classical periods. They are intellectually, spiritually, and creatively sluggish, in the words of Marinetti. And he really hated pasta. So, he's an interesting figure because he is completely anti-traditional, and despite that, the futurists are almost like proto-fascist. Like they eventually become fascist, and the left-wing elements within Futurism separate and go on to create Dada and Surrealism, which were both expressly leftist art movements at their inception.
I just want to add some historical context, because I'm a history nerd, but it is interesting that Futurism forms in basically the early 1900s, if I have it correctly.
Yeah.
Because at that point in time, Italy as a country has only existed for like 30 years.
Okay.
The Italian unification, the Rus, my Italian is bad, but I believe it's pronounced the Rus Orgomento, the unification of Italy from, many different Italian states, and I think only really completed by around about, 1870. So it's funny to me, that you're talking about these guys who are hating, tradition, because really, for a lot of Italians,
Everything was new.
it is this bizarre idea that the Kingdom of Italy, was coming about. We are a new country. We're a new nation. We are no longer, Lombards and Sicilians and so on and so forth. Now we're all Italians. And that's like, okay, well, that ends in the 1870s. And now here you have a guy like, I don't like pasta. it's really funny to me.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever get the chance, look up Tommaso's Futurist Cookbook. It's great. And this is the thing, because, they are anti-feminist, they are pro-war. In the Futurist Manifesto, we basically have like a track that is in favor of ethnic cleansing, of genocide, essentially.
Oh my goodness.
Where, Marinetti says that war is the only hygiene for the earth. This is all like 5-6 years prior to the start of World War One, and we would see a few of the futurist artists killed in action, because they praise the machine. They say that the sports car, the Ferrari, is much more beautiful than the Nike of Samothrace because it's new, it's masculine, it's fast, it's mechanical. They praise the machine gun, and then they are killed by the thing that they love. So, maybe they did something right.
Italy did not have a good record in World War One.
So, this is kind of where the kind of paradox, the problems for futurism arise, is that they don't know what to do. Italy is too far from Paris. They're behind. They're doing things that were developed in the sort of tail end of the 1800s, the 19th century. They're copying techniques of other artists, and critics of the day are saying that there are artists in Cubism that are doing the same thing as the futurists, but better. For example, Marcel Duchamp, you may know him, if you do, as a Dada artist predominantly. He's the artist behind the world's most famous urinal fountain. So he dabbled in a lot of different styles before moving into Dada. And one of them that he was quite successful in was actually Cubism. And he has a painting, I'm just going to look it up so I don't get it wrong, which I believe is called Nude Descending the Stairs. Or descending a staircase. Mm-hmm. And it is considered a classic because it uses cubist distortion to show a single figure moving through time and space in a painting. And it was considered much better than Jacopo Balla's Dynamism of a Dog on a Leash, because Balla's Dynamism of a Dog on a Leash, it's a great artwork. It shows exactly what it intends to, but it is almost on the cusp of not being modernist because of how representational it is. Whereas Duchamp's piece is, it's a textbook cubist piece, and yet it also shows dimension and space and movement, whereas a lot of other cubist pieces were quite static. So, the the futurists kind of fell into a trap where they have great ideas, they have no way of showing these ideas, and ultimately their movement is destroyed by their own ideas because the future is terrible. Modernism sucks. World War One is bad. It kills a bunch of the artists, and the art movements that they are borrowing from are already so outdated that their contemporaries can execute their own ideas better than they could. So the futurists, I didn't know too much about them before last year when I really had to research them to get to know more. And I kind of felt, should I be teaching this same kind of sanitized curriculum that I was taught, where I didn't know that the futurists were right-wing, and I didn't know that the Dadaists and the Surrealists were explicitly left-wing. I just knew that one was pro-war and one was anti-war, and the war was just a thing that happened in the background. So I decided to, you know, get a little deeper into it so that if kids had questions, I'd be able to answer them. And that's kind of, it's given me a new sense of appreciation for the futurists, because as modern as they were, as forward-thinking as they were still hindered by the fact that the things that they want, the things that they want to achieve, the things that they want to celebrate and commemorate are too conservative, are too traditional in a sense, to really allow them to kind of meld into what modernism was at the time, or at least this is my opinion of it. And it kind of reminds me of a lot of the ways in which new fascism or new conservatism has...
The new alt-right, yeah.
The new alt-right, the way it's kind of shown itself today, where it's kind of like, you know, it's very difficult to enjoy a kind of internet pop culture because you know at some point it's probably going to be appropriated for racism or for sexism or for you know, classism, or most likely an intersection of all three.
The worst form of intersectionality. But you know, it's interesting. Please continue.
But at the same time, it's like, it feels like there's a kind of parallel, there's a kind of a cyclical aspect in terms of fascism, in terms of conservatism, and probably in terms of leftism, but because that's not so much the scope right now, it's not really what I've been thinking about. But conservatism to me is always predicated on trying to preserve a sense of what should be without ever looking at what actually was.
That's a great way to put
and
it.
Because it's only looking at half of the equation, it's always kind of doomed to fail, because what is changing. What was fluid and not altogether recorded necessarily. We're always learning new things about the past, and that informs us better. But conservatism often wants to ignore aspects of the past. And maybe there's a benign type of conservatism that wants things to be comfortable, because things have gotten worse. But I still think that that kind of conservatism can find itself in a kind of, you know, center of left space, where we have to recognize that we can't make things better by going headlong into where we are. We need to make a change in a different direction. We can't go backwards. Going forwards is going to make it worse. So we need to take a different path. Yeah. But I think that taking a different path is what is scary or difficult for a conservative person to accept.
I'm not a postmodernist, because you know the foundational thing about postmodernism, and why I cringe every time I hear it online, because very few people have any real understanding of what postmodernism is. But you know, postmodernists reject the ideas of like grand central narratives to history. Like Marxists, unlike Marxists who generally believe in, you know, grand historical narratives, I nevertheless find the idea, while I'm not a postmodernist, I nevertheless find the idea that there are no, you know, historical narratives to be an attractive one. But then when you tell me about the futurists, you tell me that here we have a bunch of dudes in the early 1900s who've just experienced a counterculture revolution of, i.e., the Risso Argomento, you know. They would have been born either before, slightly before, or, you know, after, you know, in this kind of period. And that's like, well, what do they stand for? Well, they stand for things that are new. Okay. Then you say, well, they're quite anti-feminist. They're, you know, they have this obsession with like masculine violence. And and Italy is, of course, a poor backwards country that is kind of like the backwards place of Europe, you know, and Italians aren't seen in the same cultural prestige as, like, say, for example, the French. And it totally makes sense to me that a movement like futurism would develop, because it's a reaction to, quote unquote, the material conditions of Italy. You know, its poverty, its relative cultural isolation, you know, the fact that most Italians are still remembered for things that, like, they had nothing to do with, like the Roman Empire, you know. And it's funny to me that, you know, there are these that you would, well, it's not funny, but it's kind of like predictable that many of the futurists would then, you know, become fascists, because they are totally obsessed with an idea of a past and a history that they themselves don't really understand. They have this aesthetic understanding of history. You know, they see the car and they're like, yes, this is good and new and better, but they don't really, you know, understand it as a social force. They don't really understand what it's going to do to the world, in the same way that they didn't understand what the machine gun was going to do to warfare, you know. And I see this general understanding in the alt-right a lot, right?
Yeah.
Because they recognize they can't go around wearing Klan hoods. At least I hope they at least recognize that they can't do that. I would hope that we're not that bad yet. But they have adapted to this by presenting, you know, a fascism with a face, right? Racists have become, quote-unquote, race realists. And I was listening to a debate earlier today, and the race realists still don't have good arguments, you know? They still have to vaguely gesture at this kind of imaginary differences between, you know, different races and pretend that environments are, you know, negligible in their impact. I actually, funny enough, during this debate, you know, one of the race realists was like, well, he was confronted with this hypothetical situation. If you took two people and you put one of them in a home with lead in the walls and, you know, no education, and then you put the other, you know, you put the other one in a good home with good education and all of that, you know, would you admit that these people would have different outcomes, you know? And they weren't able to, you know, they just didn't want to answer that question, because that kind of question, you know, spits in the face of everything that they believe, you know, because they think that there are genetic reasons. Now, sure, they're a little bit better in terms of using fancier words to describe their racism, right? They might talk about heritability, although none of them ever understand it. I say this as a scientist, you know. I never see any really good scientific arguments, because these people are almost always trying to bend the data to fit their ideas, not the other way around. They're looking at the data and drawing conclusions. They're drawing conclusions and then trying to find data.
Yeah.
Charles Murray, great example. You know, someone who would cite incredibly poorly made IQ tests on, you know, Africans as proof of like genetic differences between black people and white people. And it's like, Charles Murray, it's just ridiculous science. But I'm getting off topic here. But the point is that the fascists of today, the alt-right and so on and so forth, they have the same idea. You know, they have this aesthetic interest in things, but at the end of the day, when it comes to it, they're not really challenging the traditional power orders of society, you know, just like the futurists and their anti-feminism. Well, in Italy in the 19th century, in the 20th century, early 20th century, women were not, I repeat, not a social power, right? They were in many cases still second or in some cases third class citizens, if you could even consider them citizens. Anti-feminism is not going against the culture, it is literally just supporting it. But the difference is the way that it has been packaged. You know, you talked about the way that the futurists tried to package themselves differently, right? Am I on the mark here?
No, I think you are. Like, this is definitely like a really interesting portrayal of futurism, because it's right. You're correct. It packages the history in a really interesting way and kind of like gives some contemporary parallels. You verbalized it really, really well. So I think I'm definitely gonna listen to this again so I can so I can keep that as a note to discuss it with my students. See what
hey,
they
maybe
think.
You should recommend them this podcast.
maybe. But yeah, no, I think I think in the end, conservatism has to lose in one way or another. Maybe it takes us with it. But
oh yeah, no, I agree.
You know, like I just don't see it as a way of really building a world.
Fascism is not stable, right? It is inherently contradictory because fascism is an attempt to deny reality, right, and interpose your will onto reality. And you can only do that for so long before reality eventually, you know, bites back. And you are confronted with a world that simply just, you know, like, for example, there's nothing that you can do to get rid of gay people, right?
Yeah.
They will just exist. They have, generally speaking, always existed. And, you know, it doesn't matter how conservative your country is, gay people still exist. You know, I was seeing in the news earlier today that... you know, one of Hungary's ministers who helped pass an anti-gay abortion bill was found at a 25-man gay orgy. And it's just like, yes, of course, because maybe he is in fact gay. And everything that he does to hurt other people, you know, is an irrational phrasing of his inability. Basically, that's it, you know, because he was always gay and nothing he can do to change that. There's nothing, you know, because reality, and, you know, conservatives, of course, live in this delusional make-believe land. You know, they claim to want things like small government, but they support, you know, the military, which is one of the biggest government institutions you can imagine. And you're right. I feel like we have to basically get people away from conservatism or they will bring us all down, you know, with them. But that, I think, is a different talk. We are running out of time here for today's episode. So just to summarize, what would you want the viewers at home to take away from this meander through art history?
I think whatever art you like is the art that you should support and buy, whether it's left-wing art, whether it's right-wing art, whether it's conservative, whether it's progressive. Because I think ultimately the best function of art is as a lens or view into a society at a particular time. And for me to make the argument that one type of artwork is better than the other is not only like a losing game, I think it's it does a disservice to sort of humanity at large. I think our image of modernism and why its many projects failed would not be as well formed if we didn't have the futurists to look at, in addition to the successes like Kandinsky, Picasso, Duchamp. So, you know, history, posterity, looking back, we need the winners and we need the losers. And sometimes I think the best thing you can do is be brave enough to be a loser. and, you know, that's why I haven't given up making art yet. Someone making bad art, it should be me.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. Here I am making a bad podcast. You gotta do things, you know. I am not a conservative. I am the furthest away from conservatives. My belief is not to... Yeah. I don't think I can fundamentally destroy conservatism, you know, as an idea. Any more than conservatives can destroy gay people. But I do think that being a progressive, you know, trying to push the boundaries of your art, trying to push what you can do, trying to express yourself better, trying to understand the world better, I think all of these things ultimately abet in human happiness. And I think that conservatives are unhappy people who post hoc justify their unhappiness as some kind of natural order to the world. And the more we can make them realize that, no, you don't have to be this miserable way. You can do something. You can believe in freedom, right? You know, to use that example, I don't have a problem with that guy, that politician, going to the gay orgy. I don't. It's no skin off my back, you know? I would never
hypocrisy,
want
hypocrisy, that's the
yeah.
issue.
Yeah, I would never want him to have the freedom not to do that, right? You know, consenting adults and all of that stuff. But the fact that he used his power to hurt other people who are presumably like him tells me that there is a disconnection between how he sees the world and how he sees himself. And if art is
Yes.
not the tool to bridge that gap, then I don't know what is. But that is all the time we have for today's episode. Sibu, would you like to shout out anything on your, you know, anything while you're here?
My friends and I, we started a collective sometime last year. We are Good on Paper, and you can find us on Instagram at We Are Good on Paper. Each word is separated by a full stop.
I will put a link to that in the description of this.
Okay, great.
This video or podcast, wherever you're listening to it. Yeah, just make sure to send me that later.
I'll send you the link.
Anything else?
That's all I can think about.
All right.
Wear a mask, sanitize, all that jazz.
So this has been another Bite Mark special episode. You can find us on YouTube. If you're watching this on YouTube, like the video, you know, comment. Maybe what's your favorite artist or period of art that you like. Share the video around, please. You know, subscribe. If you're anywhere else, I'm sure you're listening to this, you know, Google Podcasts. Or, you know, Apple iTunes, Spotify, etc. We're on many platforms. You can find us there. We've got a Patreon. You know, if you have some spare money that is not going to a good use, maybe you can help finance the show and help keep us going. It really helps, just a dollar a month. But yeah, we've got a Reddit, we've got a subreddit, we've got all the social medias, Instagram, Twitter. Please check in the description. We're funny, you know. On other social media, guys, you can check us out. Have a good evening. Take care. As Sibu said, sanitize, wear your mask. Be safe, everyone. Goodbye.
Goodbye.